From KCOR News, this is Casey Currents, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Alex Smith.
And I'm Suzanne Hogan. Susan Wilson is away this week. On this week's show, local reactions to the burning of the mosque in Joplin, Missouri.
What we have to do is keep on trying to put the positive messages out there and show that there's a lot of support within the Muslim community, but also the greater community, that we won't stand for that kind of violence in our society.
Plus, we meet some of Kansas City's Sikh community.
Every time the U.S. goes to war overseas, I've been from that country. I've been accused of being Syrian, Libyan, Iranian.
And breaking down what can seem to be a complicated issue in Missouri and Kansas, Medicaid.
Medicaid covers about 60 million people, low-income parents, children, seniors, and people with disabilities. States are in charge of the program, but it's run in this sort of partnership with the federal government.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news. I'm Alex Smith.
And I'm Suzanne Hogan, filling in for Susan Wilson this week. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
Last week saw two tragic attacks on small religious communities in the Midwest. On Sunday, a shooter killed six people at a Sikh temple in Wisconsin, and the next day, a mosque in Joplin was burned to the ground. KSMU's Jennifer Davidson has this story on the incident in Joplin.
The imam of the mosque, Dr. Lahmadine Lahmadine, had only finished leading the special Taraweeh night prayers a few hours before he was awakened by a phone call from the Jasper County Sheriff's Department. That prayer takes place every night around 10 o'clock during the month of Ramadan. Lahmadine got in his car and started driving.
I could see the smoke from about 2 miles when I drove to the mosque. So when I saw that, my heart pounding, and I hope it's not from the mosque. But when I got in there, it is from the mosque.
This is the third time the Islamic community in Joplin has had to deal with fires on its property. 1 month ago, a man was caught on camera throwing a burning object onto the mosque's roof. The FBI is offering a $15,000 reward for the arrest and indictment of those responsible for that fire. You can see a picture of that man by going to fbi.gov/Kansas City. Bridget Patton is a spokeswoman for the FBI out of Kansas City.
If it is determined that this fire was deliberately set, we will actively investigate to see if there is any connection or relationship to the fire that occurred at this center on July 4th of this year.
The Islamic Center of Joplin hosted volunteers from around the country after the Joplin tornado. This week's fire was a total loss. Imam Lahmadine says he doesn't know where his congregation will gather to worship now. Typically, during Ramadan, Muslims gather every evening at the mosque to break their fasts before praying into the night. The fire comes less than 2 weeks before the Muslim Eid al-Fitr holiday, which is next Friday. For KSMU News, I'm Jennifer Davidson.
An investigation is ongoing involving the FBI, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and the Jasper County Sheriff's Department. But the incident sent shockwaves through Kansas City's Muslim community. Susan Wilson spoke with Minaj Shabir about it. She's an advisor to the Midland Islamic Council.
So where were you when you first found out about the burning of the Joplin Mosque?
I was actually working on, it was Monday morning, I had received an email from one of the organizations informing me of the event. And then I set out to let others know, not just in our immediate community, but also with law enforcement in our area, so that they are aware of what had happened in Joplin.
So I know you can't speak for all Muslims in Kansas and Missouri, of course, but in your circles, what's been the reaction to the burning of the mosque in Joplin?
Well, it's the burning of the mosque in Joplin and the incident that happened in Wisconsin to the Sikh community. Across the board, it really hit us deeply because right now we're in the month of Ramadan. Every night we're gathering at a masjid, doing prayers. Most weekends the facilities are busy with iftar programs. That Saturday night, I was at one of the events, and I was just thinking if something should happen like that happened in Wisconsin, we had kids, you know, running around. Everyone would have been pretty vulnerable. So it makes us kind of stop and think of what could happen, you know, what would happen if it's happened to one of our areas. So it makes us, you know, we think it it's over there, but even this town in Wisconsin, it's just like America, USA. It could be any place. And what we have to do is keep on trying to put the positive messages out there and show that there's a lot of support from not in the Muslim within the Muslim community, but also the greater community, that as a greater community, we won't stand for that kind of violence in our society. Unfortunately, they've been targeted several times now with vandalism. So unfortunately, the one in July actually was captured on video of who had done it. They haven't been able to find the person. They've asked the community to come forth to see if they can identify this person. And there's been a reward from different organizations to find the person.
Do you know who is providing the award?
Yeah, right now I know of two specifically. One is from the Council of American Islamic Relations Care. They have $10,000. And then ISNA, Islamic Society of North America, they have $15,000 that they've put up. I think everyone wants to get to the root cause of finding who the person is so it doesn't get repeated. And then, you know, there was another incident in Rhode Island. Unfortunately, it seems like, you know, during the election period, when certain individuals that are elected officials or running for office use Islam in let's beat Islam and try to get votes, we see a spike of these kind of violence. And even the incident that happened in Wisconsin, you know, the person there was looking for Muslims. Now, he was ignorant and he didn't understand the distinction between Sikhs and Muslims, but he thought he was going there to kill Muslims. And that's what's scary for us as well.
Have you had any contact with the Sikh community since that incident occurred? Or are you working with the Sikhs to come up with some common approaches to how you respond to these kinds of things?
Well, right after the incident, we got word of it. We send out press releases and media statements, both the Crescent Peace Society and Middle Islamic Council. And I had forwarded also to the Sikh community, and they were very appreciative of it. In fact, they wanted to take those communications and forward it to their communities as well.
Going back to the reward, is that a signal that perhaps the Muslim community is not sure that left to its own devices that law enforcement has either enough resources or enough will to identify the person?
No, I think, you know, I've been working with law enforcement in different areas, and I know that they really want to find these folks. I think this just helps, if there was somebody who knows something about it and if they're motivated by a financial reward, that will have them come forth. You know, some people will just do it because it's the right thing to do. But for those who feel that, you know, this is a motivation, a motivator is to have a financial reward, then hopefully that will help.
To what extent do you think the world coverage of maybe more Islamic extremists who may be in some cases anti-America, how much do you think those images fuel some of the hatred that you see here?
I think it does. It's unfortunate, and that does not represent Islam. I mean, if people really want to know about Islam, they can do some research and they can go back that even in the Middle Ages period, that Islam was a haven where other faiths were being persecuted. They were able to live in solidarity, like in Spain. But unfortunately, again, you have bad people doing bad things, and we have that in all faiths, and terrorism has no religion, as we can see. And so bad news, unfortunately, gets more play in the media than good news. And there are so many good things that are happening. Like, for example, those physicians that are at the mosque in Joplin, in the post-tornado of Joplin, many of those physicians lost their own home. They lost their clinics that they were doing the free health care, but they worked constantly without a break taking care of the people of Joplin. I mean, that because that's what they do. But did any of that get any more of a media attention? No, it didn't. And you know, and people do things like you and I will do things not because we want to get attention. We do it because it's the right thing to do. These are people who are Muslims. They are physicians. And they wanted to do the same thing.
Now, you talked about the impact of the elections and the media. But do you see these attacks on the Joplin Mosque and these other hate crimes a sign of anti-Muslim feelings being on the rise, or are these just isolated incidents, or is it hard to tell?
No, it's the Council of American Islamic Relations has been keeping track of hate crimes and discrimination to Muslim workers in the workforce. It has been increasing, and it started from 9/11. I tell the story of Alia Ansari, who is an Afghan woman who was walking in Sacramento to pick up her daughter from school, and she had her, like, a 2 or 3 year old daughter in her hand. She came as an Afghan refugee, and while she was walking to school, a man pulled up in a pickup truck and just stopped and shot her point blank in the head. The only thing was she was wearing a headscarf. And as she was lying dying there, she knew as soon as she let go of her daughter's hand, you know, there won't be anybody to watch her. So I think of her as an example of being very vulnerable. And so, no, I don't think that it's here and there, but I would say that it's been increasing. And at the time of the elections, unfortunately, you know, the politicians need to really be responsible for what they're saying. I don't know what's going to happen between now and November. I'm just kind of holding my breath, and I just hope that the political folks will be more responsible.
Well, thank you for being with us on KC Currents.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
Manaj Shabir is an advisor to the Midland Islamic Council and the Crescent Peace Society.
While the Wisconsin shooting Shabir mentioned is the most dramatic attack on Sikhs in recent memory, members of that faith often experience harassment and discrimination. On Wednesday evening, Kansas City's Sikh community hosted a vigil to remember the Wisconsin victims and to promote tolerance. Alex was there.
Under a shelter which overlooks Shawnee Mission Lake, about 150 people gathered to chant, pray, and reflect. As a thunderstorm loomed in the sky, Sikh community leaders and a priest took turns addressing the solemn audience. Young and old hands carried lit candles, and most people wore blue, the Sikh color of peace. Many at the vigil were Sikhs, and many weren't, but they all shared the same reasons for being there.
My name is Pyara Singh, and I live in Olathe, Kansas. We are here to in the remembrance of those killed in Wisconsin, and especially for the police officer who come and save all of us.
I'm Dr. Gurinder Singh, the founders of this country. They wanted religious freedom. That's why they came here. They formed this country, and now the minorities, the religious freedom is threatened by these stray, uninformed few.
My name is Linda Santee. I'm a Methodist. I wanted to show support, show that we're all Americans, no matter what color you are, no matter what religion you are. And I wanted to learn a little bit about the Sikh religion, and I did, and it's very interesting.
Sure, I'm Sarabjit Singh Gugnani. Obviously, this is being observed as the Solidarity Day to express that we also have the same common goal for peace, peace for all. Something that happened to our community should not happen to anybody else.
The Sikh religion started in the Punjab region around the border between India and Pakistan in the 1400s. Sikhs believe in one God and the equality of all people. Men of the faith often take the last name of Singh, which means lion. Women take the name of Kaur, which means princess. Sikh men are often recognizable because they usually wear turbans, which cover long hair. Ishwinder Singh Chota, who helped organize the vigil, explains the importance of the turban.
And that has two meanings. One is to keep a sign of respect to God, because God's around us everywhere. God doesn't just exist in a church. He doesn't exist, you know, on certain days of the week. God's with us everywhere. So we keep our head kind of a sign of covered as a respect to God. And the second part is that by having the turban, you're identifiable as a Sikh. It's the only religion that men are required to wear a turban. Islam, they not really, some of the priests and whatnot will wear it, and some traditions they do wear turbans for different reasons. But in Sikhism, you're required to have it because every Sikh male should be easily identifiable. And the reason why is that that way you have to constantly in the act according to the principles of Sikhism in the proper ways. You couldn't wear a turban and go do something wrong, because then everybody would be like, okay, you know the guy who did that crime was the guy with the turban. The guy who broke into the store, oh yeah, I can recognize him. You know, he had a turban on. So it's so that you're identifiable in a crowd. So anywhere you go in a crowd, you can identify a Sikh. And it also reminds us that since we are identifiable, we have to act according to the principles of our religion.
But the turbans have often made Sikhs the targets of harassment, and Kansas City Sikhs are no strangers to this abuse.
Right after September 11th, we had just moved from the East Coast to Kansas City, and my parents bought a store in Edgerton, Kansas, and people vandalized our store the day after September 11th. It was just months after we'd bought the store, just anti-Muslim remarks, and I mean, we're not Muslim, we're Sikhs, but I mean, that still doesn't make it okay. Even if it was a Muslim, it doesn't make it okay. But that's when I felt it. I remember my dad calling, I was at Shawnee Mission South then, and he called the school and he's like, I'm gonna come pick you guys up because of what happened at the store. It was very scary.
Every time the U.S. goes to war overseas, I've been from that country. I've been accused of being Syrian, Libyan, Iranian, Libyan, Egyptian, just all that stuff, because a lot of people have the misconception that turbans, you know, a turban individual with a beard is a Arab. And that's a misconception, unfortunately, that for many years media perpetuates. Like if you see a bunch of action movies, you'll see guys boarding the plane have turban and big old buffy beards and whatnot. But I've had threats. I've had Ku Klux Klan people come after me, physically come after me. I try not to fight and get in fights, but I have been cornered. And in those occasions, I've had to, you know, protect myself. But that's only after I've been hit and kicked and punched and things thrown at.
I've been called names, and when we go for a walk, sometimes people would shout and then pass by in the cars. That way we don't always have an opportunity to educate or tell them about the religion or why we wear the turban or why we maintain the beard.
My name is Gagan Sani. It's especially when I was growing up during middle school and stuff like that. You hear it every day. Every time we go to school, you hear it. There were times of being bullied in school because of it. But our faith teaches us to overcome that. You know, and regardless of what obstacles life throws at you, your devotion to God will always overcome that.
Kansas City is home to around 1,500 Sikhs. There may be as many as 500,000 in the U.S. and around 30 million worldwide. For Casey Currents, I'm Alex Smith.
Coming up, KCUR's Alana Gordon breaks down Medicaid in Missouri and Kansas. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Suzanne Hogan.
And I'm Alex Smith.
Now that the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled on the federal health law, we'll be hearing a lot more about one of its key aspects, Medicaid. The court ruling gave states the option whether or not to expand the program, and Kansas Governor Sam Brownback doesn't want to implement any of the law, including an expansion. In Missouri, Governor Jay Nixon has said he's still reviewing the matter to determine what's best for Missouri.
It'll deserve thorough discussion. It's a serious issue.
An expansion's not the only issue. There are also other Medicaid provisions state and federal policymakers are still fleshing out. But before we delve much more into all of this, we at Casey Currents want to know, what exactly is Medicaid anyways? And who's covered by it? We're going to talk to KCUR's health reporter, Alana Gordon. Hey, Alana, welcome to Casey Currents.
Hey, thanks for having me. So part of the answer to your question about what exactly Medicaid is and what it covers depends on what state you live in. But basically, Medicaid is this huge public insurance program. It formed in 1965, same time that Congress created Medicare, the program for seniors age 65 and older, and some people with disabilities. So Medicaid covers about 60 million people, low-income parents, children, seniors, and people with disabilities. And that's according to the health research group, the Kaiser Family Foundation. States are in charge of the program, but it's run in this sort of partnership with the federal government. So I recently spoke with Ryan Barker. He's with the Missouri Foundation for Health. He does a lot of research on Missouri's Medicaid program, and he puts it this way.
So there are federal minimums for some of the eligibility categories, but states can go above those minimums if they choose to. So certain categories, Missouri is higher than other states, and certain categories, Missouri is lower or at the federal minimum. But there is some state flexibility built into the Medicaid program.
So states run the Medicaid program, but if they don't follow certain baseline coverage and eligibility requirements, they lose federal funding. So the federal government does pay a large part of this program. And losing that funding is significant because of that, what's often referred to as this match for the services that are provided. So certain services have to be covered in order to keep that funding in order to run the program, things like emergency care, prenatal care. And then there are these optional benefits, things like dental, prescription drug coverage, which most states cover anyway, home and community-based services.
So what does all this look like in Missouri and Kansas?
Well, in Kansas, about 1 in 10 people, or 300,000 people, have Medicaid. And in Missouri, about 1 in 7 people has Medicaid, and that's nearly a million residents. But the eligibility depends on whether someone's a kid or a parent, and that can vary based on, in each state, there's different eligibilities for those things. In order for parents to be eligible in Missouri, they must be at 18% of the federal poverty level. So what does that mean? So a single mom with 2 kids making less than $3,500 a year makes her eligible for Medicaid. Parents' incomes in Missouri actually used to be higher, but the state scaled that back a lot in 2005. Ryan Barker, again with the Missouri Foundation for Health, told me that for kids, eligibility is a different story.
Missouri is one of the top 5 most generous states when it comes to children's eligibility. So between our Medicaid program and what is called our CHIP program, which is our children's health insurance program, and in Missouri, we have a combined program, and that eligibility for kids goes all the way up to 300% of poverty.
Kids are covered at a higher level than parents. In Missouri, more than a third of kids in the state have Medicaid coverage. In Kansas, eligibility for parents is a bit higher than in Missouri, but it's actually lower for kids. For example, for a family of 3, that household income cutoff to be eligible is about $11,000 less than in Missouri. You do see these fluctuations and differences depending on what side of the state line you live in. But at the same time, there are certain base level services that Medicaid, as this large public insurance program, does cover.
So we're hearing a lot about parents and kids, but what about just adults without kids?
Well, that's a really good question, because a lot of the focus of these debates around Medicaid and around this expansion has to do with adults, and specifically adults who don't have kids. Childless adults is how kind of the common referred to phrase for it. And currently these adults in most states, and that includes Kansas and Missouri, are not eligible for Medicaid. Doesn't matter based on your income. Now, if you have a disability, that's a different situation. But based on income alone, no matter what, childless adults aren't eligible for Medicaid. This optional expansion would change that. Now, pregnant women are covered. They're actually at a higher eligibility level than that expansion. So about half of births in Missouri are covered by Medicaid, which I think is pretty interesting.
Where exactly do seniors and people with disabilities fit into all of this?
Within Medicaid, parents and kids make up the majority of the population that Medicaid programs cover in Missouri and Kansas. But for example, in Kansas, seniors and people with disabilities make up just a third of the program, but they account for more than 3/4 of the program's costs. And when you think about it, that kind of makes sense, because when you have higher health needs as a senior or someone with disabilities, you're going to have greater health needs. I spoke with Scott Bruner, who is with the Kansas Health Institute. He used to be heavily involved in the state's Medicaid program. He pointed out another reason for this. Medicaid, and this is the case across states, is the main coverage option for long-term care services and nursing home stays. So Medicare, which is that program for seniors 65 and older, kind of as long as you've worked 10 years or so, you're eligible for Medicare. Medicare does not cover long-term care.
Medicaid is the only public payer for those kinds of services. So as people age and they run through their resources, what they've saved over time, they start out as being cash payers for nursing facility care. As their resources dwindle, they spend themselves into poverty and become eligible for Medicaid. Then Medicaid starts paying for their long-term care stays.
So in Missouri, Medicaid covers more than half of all nursing home care in the state. So it's kind of within this development of these different coverage options. Most private insurance plans don't cover that sort of thing as well.
Well, Lana, I think I'm understanding it more, and thank you so much for breaking it down for us. We're going to be continuing to talk about it over the next couple weeks.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the issues around Medicaid from a state perspective in terms of how Kansas and Missouri are dealing with the cost of it, the care aspects, so many things are going on with this right now. We're only going to be hearing more about it with the national discussions around the Affordable Care Act and the health law and the future of that, but also just within how states are dealing with these large health coverage systems in and of themselves in the states.
We're going to have a resource page about all this on our website at kcur.org. So while we have you here, we're going to switch gears. You had an interesting workout this week. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so there's this massive community workout in Lawrence that's been going on for nearly 3 decades that I've been wanting to check out. It's run by this former Marine and police officer. He used to be Lawrence High School security guard. He goes by the nickname Red Dog, and his real name's Don Gardner. And the workouts called Dog Days are kind of a fixture in the community.
Down and up. Five. Get your hands out wide. Wide push-ups on me. Get them out wide where you're comfortable.
Are there a lot of people there?
There's a range anywhere from 100 or so to several hundred, but some people have been there for like 15 years or more. The workouts are only like 45 minutes, and they take place in the mornings and evenings. And during the summer, which just ended, the workouts happen either inside or right next to KU's Memorial Stadium. So I really wanted to find out what it is that keeps regulars returning to this workout and new people coming. So I stopped by at 6 a.m. when it was still dark out last Monday.
My name is Don Gardner, and I'm called Red Dog since junior high days by my junior high coach.
All right, here we go. Down, up, down.
My name is Catherine Glidewell. How would I describe Red Dog? He loves to tell people what to do.
I'm Cora Griffin. She's pretty cool.
He is kind of charismatic in his own way of being a 74-year-old ex-military man who just loves people.
Here we go. Down. Get down, Catherine. Here we go. 11 leg lifts.
But no, Red Dog, this is his family, and so he works really hard to make a great workout for everyone. He wants people to feel motivated to not only be in better shape, but be a better person. My name is Reagan Dodd, and I've been coming, I think this is my 4th year.
All right, this one you like. Hands behind your head, elbows back, on Reagan, side bends.
Ready, left, right.
Good. Louder. Left. Let's wake up football.
Right. Left. Right.
It's a workout program that was started in 1984 for high school kids, and it just progressed to more and more people, little kids, adults, all kinds. And it started out for Lawrence High football, and then it was Lawrence High sports, then Free State sports, and it just kept growing. Families, little brother, little sister would come because big brother, big sister did it.
And so why do you do this?
I don't know. I'm crazy. It's fun. I didn't think that at 4:45 this morning, but it's fun, and it's great to have all these people. We have a lot of friends made from it over the years. I've got a lot of former high school kids that still come see me, call me. That's worth all of it.
What makes a good workout?
Well, if you're sweating good, I think you should enjoy yourself. I think, you know, any sport, you should at least be having some fun. Some days, no, but. On your feet.
My name is Michael Cordova. You can work out on your own, but when you see, oh, I can beat that guy or I can beat that lady. So you try and try and try, and it keeps me coming back and forth because I used to tell my wife, gosh, that guy beat me. He shouldn't beat me. So I try to do better, but that's what I like about it.
You know, you're doing the best you can. It's not competitive. Everyone roots for everybody else, and it's just a great atmosphere.
My name is Bob Shum. I own Buffalo Bob's Smokehouse and the Dynamite Saloon. That's my day job. In the evening, I'm the mayor. I mean, when I started, I could hardly do anything, and I just decided that I needed to do something in order to live longer and healthier. So little by little, I started coming on a regular basis, and then I became very enthusiastic about it, so much so that just in this last year, this spring, I ran a half marathon for the first time in my life, and I'm 65, so that's pretty cool, I think.
It's good seeing the people's accomplishments. We get to know everybody, you know, when 400 or 500 people here, I pretty well know all of their names. If I don't know their name, I at least know their face. I'm Beverly Gardner. I'm Red Dog's wife.
Do you normally refer to your husband as Red Dog?
I do when I'm out. If I yell Don, he doesn't pay attention, but if I yell, hey, Red Dog, he'll answer.
Yeah, I don't hear as well.
All right, folks, we're going to come up into this parking lot, out around the street, over to 11th, up on the other side of the stadium.
My name's Rachel Sine, and I am here at Dog Days trying to lose weight.
My kids always did the summer Dog Days, and they got me started on it. And then they both went off to college, and I just kept going, so... I'm Lisa Fredrickson.
What are you doing right now?
We're walking backwards up Campanile Hill between the football stadium and the Campanile, which is, I believe, a World War II memorial.
How would you describe the task at hand?
I've never made it all the way up to the top without having to walk.
I'd say it was a good workout. They're probably calling us names, but mean names. Because running up that hill backwards is tough. I mean, you don't have to run if you want to walk. But we want people to feel better, get in a little better shape, and hopefully they survive longer.
That audio postcard of Don Red Dog Gardner's year-round community workout in Lawrence, now in its 29th year, was produced by KCUR's Alana Gordon. You can see photos of the event online at kcur.org.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives, and we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
Herculaneum, Missouri, a small town on the bluffs above the Mississippi River, was always a company town. The company Doe Run is the largest lead producer in North America, trucking in lead from Missouri's rich mines to a 120-year-old smelter on the river.
For 25 years, the smelter didn't meet federal air standards for lead, and now, after decades of battling government regulators and angry parents, Doe Run is leaving town at the end of next year. From the Health and Wealth Desk at KBIA in Columbia, Missouri, Jacob Finston has this story.
A small town on the bluffs above the Mississippi River, Herculaneum, Missouri, was always a company town.
The company town, I mean, the whistle blew for the start of each shift. The whistle blew at noon.
It would blow at 1. It would blow at 3. Everybody kind of lived by it.
The company is called Doe Run.
This town was built basically by Doe Run.
Doe Run's business is lead.
They all want to keep talking about lead, but we're talking about a combination of lead, cadmium, zinc, sulfur, sulfuric acid. Those are scary words.
Back in 1978, the Clean Air Act set a national standard for how much lead in the air was safe to breathe. But the smelter here in Herculaneum didn't meet that standard for 25 years. Lead from the plant building up in neighbors' yards and homes, playgrounds and schools, and in the blood of children.
Lead to me and children, you might as well give them arsenic. I mean, it's just so tragic. Every organ in our body can be impacted by lead.
Somebody explain to me when these kids are not going to be exposed anymore. That's all we're after.
The battles over contamination turned this town on its head, pitting neighbor against neighbor, uprooting and bulldozing the center of town. It all culminated with a storm of lawsuits. One of them, against the Environmental Protection Agency, forced the federal government to revise the National Air Pollution Standard for lead, tightening it by a factor of 10. Now, unable to meet the new tough standard, Doe Run is finally closing up shop here. The last primary lead smelter in the United States will be dismantled at the end of next year.
Personally, it was like a kick in the stomach.
That's City Administrator Jim Kasten. He says without Doe Run, the schools will be short $500,000 in revenue. The Water and Sewer District will lose a quarter of its budget.
You know, the biggest concern and the biggest bummer for this whole thing for me is the 270-something people that work there and their jobs and their families and how that's going to affect them and how that ripple effects comes down.
In June, Doe Run made it final. They won't be rebuilding here with a new, cleaner plant. That would be an unacceptable financial risk.
I just wanted to be able to say, ha, you didn't win. We got them. They're still here. But I guess they did win.
This is the story of a decade-long battle between angry parents, government regulators, environmentalists, and the largest lead producer in North America. It begins on an August night in 2001.
All the trucks traveled this road.
Most of the time.
Most of the time. And there was the dust was on the sides of the streets here, both sides.
Jack and Leslie Warden are showing me around their old neighborhood, blocks from the Doe Run plant. This is where they raised their son, but in the late 90s, they started wondering how safe it was. For one thing, there was this thick dust on the streets where the trucks drove in from the lead mines.
Jack Warden had been telling me about lead dust on our dust coming from trucks on the roads, and that wasn't something we'd really considered.
Dave Mosby worked for the Missouri Department of Natural Resources. After a community meeting in Herculaneum one night, Jack convinced him to take a look at the dust on the streets outside.
We went out with him late at night, and I could see, even by the street lamp, that it was likely to be contaminated with heavy metals. It had a metallic luster.
This is what the contamination on the streets was.
Warden is holding up a small glass jar. This is from the dust sample he and Dave Mosby took that night 11 years ago.
I don't like getting it anywhere on the house.
It looks kind of like pencil dust, like if you sharpen a pencil.
This was all over. It covered the sidewalk in areas. Kids would ride their bicycle down the street and they'd see that dust. Well, they'd lock the brakes up, slide the back tire around on the bicycle, dust would just go flying. And that's what they were breathing, 30% lead.
300,000 parts per million lead, as I recall, that's 30% lead, pure lead.
We begged and begged and begged, and Jack strong-armed poor Dave Mosby into doing that test. But when the tests come out, were we happy about it? We cried. We cried, 30% lead, our kids were playing it. It still gets me. You know, it wasn't good news.
But it did lead to action. The Department of Natural Resources issued a cease and desist order, and soon federal health officials got involved.
We tested all the kids that lived in that first quarter mile, half mile, three-fourths mile.
Denise Jordan is a Geary with the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry. That's part of the Centers for Disease Control. In 2001, the agency worked with state and local health officials to try to test every kid under six for lead in their blood. The results, she says, weren't exactly surprising.
I think we were all appalled. Not surprised, appalled that it was this bad.
They laid out the results like a bullseye, concentric circles of contamination radiating out from the Doe Run smelter. Within a quarter mile, 56% of kids had high levels of lead in their blood. At a half mile, it was 52%. Jordan Izagiri says she'd never seen numbers like that, except in the developing world.
But it was tragic to see in the United States on a company that was under EPA and MDNR.
Another study found a cluster of people with ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, a fatal neurological disorder. There were three cases within a three-mile radius of the smelter. That's triple the expected rate. But Jordan Izagiri says it was too small of a sample to really provide any answers.
Yes, it appeared that there were elevated number of ALS, but I couldn't do anything for those people that we talked to who had it. It was nothing. And I couldn't say a lot to the family except sort of kind of share in their grieving.
My name's Donna Lovelace. My husband was Kenny Lovelace.
Kenny Lovelace put in 18 years at Doe Run. He was a maintenance man in the center plant.
The center plant was, I always was told that it was the dirtiest place in the plant.
In 1988, Doe Run was fined for 177 health violations at the plant, accused of breaking virtually every section of the workplace lead standard. That was about the same time Lovelace started getting these strange symptoms.
Weakness in his arms, legs. He did fall several times, and he was working a lot of overtime, and, you know, we just kind of chalked it up to him being tired and overwork.
A neurologist told them he had lead poisoning, but his symptoms kept getting worse. Finally, around 1993, Lovelace was diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease. He passed away 7 years later at age 35.
I truly believe that the lead poisoning is what caused his illness. I feel that if he had not been working there, he would still be here.
Deep down, you know that the lead didn't help your health none.
Lawrence Casey. His family has been in Herculaneum since the smelter opened in the early 1890s.
About three generations of us that moved here and lived here and worked here.
Now, Casey is one of the last holdouts here in the center of town. In 2002, Doe Run and state and federal regulators decided it was easier to get rid of the people than the pollution. The company agreed to buy out the 160 homes closest to the smelter.
The prices they offered was not comparable to prices around the Herculaneum area. You couldn't buy nothing for what they was offering.
But most people did sell. The houses were bulldozed, and today the old neighborhood looks kind of like a private park, an unobtrusive fence, and little signs reading Doe Run, No Trespassing, Lead Contamination. But the buyout wasn't the end of the story. Around that same time in 2002, Doe Run met the Clean Air Act lead standard for the first time ever since it was set in 1978.
Doe Run had lowered their production.
Leslie Warden again.
They had done the yard remediation. They were sweeping the streets. They were washing the trucks. They were, you know, going through all of this dog and pony show.
But even though the air was meeting federal standards, it was still recontaminating people's yards with lead. Warden took the question to Maxine Lapellis at Washington University's Environmental Law Clinic.
If they're meeting the air standard and we're seeing this kind of recontamination, is there a problem with the air standard? And we determined that that was a superb question.
By law, the EPA is required to review the lead air standard every 5 years to make sure it matches up with current science on public health. But Lapellis discovered the agency had never completed a full review. She filed a lawsuit against the EPA in 2004. 4 years later, the agency released a new national lead standard. It was 10 times more restrictive than the old one. Doe Run agreed to close the smelter rather than trying to meet the new standard. Dana Skelly with the EPA.
It was a business decision on Doe Run's part to shut down the smelter in December of 2013.
So why did all this take 30-something years? Kathleen Logan-Smith with the Missouri Coalition for the Environment says environmental laws don't work how most people think.
Most people assume that pollution standards are like speed limits. You know, it's 65, you're over 65, you're breaking the law, you get a ticket or some kind of penalty. But environmental standards don't actually work that way.
So it's not like you have to meet this number or you get hit by this regulatory hammer.
Dave Mosby, who worked for the Missouri Department of Natural Resources. It's DNR's job to sit down with polluters and design a plan to meet national air standards. So Doe Run kept making these plans, then taking all the steps they said they would in the plan, but still managing to exceed Clean Air Act limits.
They met what they said they would do, but it just didn't work. The way it's written is, you have to do these things that should get you in compliance. But if they're wrong, then there wasn't an additional stick that you could, you know, force them to meet that number, other than to renegotiate. So there was just a series of these things because they could never meet it.
Now, the future here after Doe Run is still a big question mark.
Supply and demand. Do we have someone ready to sign the dotted line right now?
Developer Stacy Hasty. His group wants to buy the old smelter site by the river. Over the next few years, they plan to clean up the lead and build a port and commerce park.
We already have identified 2 to 4 end users for the port, which is outstanding at this point in time. And, you know, we're being told, build it. When we see it, there's a lot more to come after that.
In the meantime, Herculaneum is already changing. Real estate's cheap, and St. Louis is just a 30-mile commute.
Fairly good value, cheaper homes down here, so that's why we came down here.
Mike Watson moved here a few years ago. Tonight, he's at a Cub Scout meet with his kids.
Two kids. One, Tristan, who's going to be 9 August, and then about a year and a half old, Sean.
We're standing in a park about a half mile from the smelter, the smokestack poking above the trees. But Watson moved here after all the fighting with the EPA, DNR, and Doe Run. He says he's not worried about lead exposure.
I really haven't seen the concern. I mean, obviously you don't see lead or anything like that, but I don't really feel that it's a big of a problem as people, you know, make it out to be.
As old-timers move away and newcomers move in, the town is growing out toward the freeway.
car dealerships, gas stations, fast food restaurants, the center of gravity is shifting away from the river and the smelter's towering smokestack.
It's something that you didn't think would ever be gone.
Mayor Bill Haggard.
And now it's you kind of want to see it gone. I want to see what it looks like. The river setting out there, what this looks like without smokestacks sticking up.
As the town struggles to replace lost jobs and revenue, at least people will be breathing better. Closing the smelter will mean 30 tons of lead and more than 100,000 tons of carbon dioxide that won't be in the air each year. From the Health and Wealth Desk, I'm Jacob Fenston.
Coming up, a summer of mystery. The local theater group performs the play The Mousetrap by Agatha Christie. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Alex Smith.
And I'm Suzanne Hogan. In area news this week, the Catholic Diocese released a report on sexual abuse. Most Republicans voted for conservatives in Missouri and Kansas primaries, and Kansasians voted to raise their taxes a little. KCUR's Steve Bell looks back at those and other top stories of the week in the Weekend Review.
Kansas City solidly approved a half-cent sales tax increase and in the process gave a resounding vote of confidence to Mayor Sly James.
We get to establish our street maintenance fund and actually get some work done on streets, rebuilding, repaving, and we get to dedicate some more money to our parks department so that they can maintain our parks better, operate our community centers better, and move forward in a positive way.
Kansas City voters also approved $500 million in bond to finance phase one of revamping the aging sewer system. The primaries changed the balance of Kansas politics.
The moderates in the Senate blocked every single major policy change that the governor won. That will probably end tonight.
Is how Representative Jim Denning put it after he defeated moderate Overland Park Senator Tim Owens. Wichita State University political science professor Ed Flinchy phrased it differently.
The purge.
Governor Brownback wants to keep cutting taxes, gain power in appointing judges, tighten immigration laws, and change school funding. With conservatives ousting moderates from the state Senate, he'll likely get his way. Conservative candidates racked up big victories in Missouri's Republican primary, too. Conservative Congressman Todd Akin will challenge Democratic U.S. Senator Claire McCaskill. McCaskill said Akin's opposing the minimum wage and government programs for student loans made him her opponent of choice.
That means if you don't have the money to send your child to school, your child can't get a loan to go to school, which means only the rich kids are going to college.
But some said in Missouri's current conservative climate, Akin may still oust the incumbent. Missouri voters also overwhelmingly approved a constitutional amendment that permits public prayer and allows students to opt out of school assignments that conflict with their religious beliefs. The day after the election, as predicted, the ACLU filed a suit challenging part of the law reducing religious freedoms for prison inmates.
There are likely to be quite a few challenges to Amendment 2. Either challenges to the law or also instances in which Amendment 2 is used as a defense for activity that violates the First Amendment and the separation of state and church.
Commented the ACLU's Tony Rothert. The area Catholic Diocese released a report on sexual abuse and boundary violations. Church Ombudsman Jennifer Valenti said though there were 79 suspicious incidents reported, most were either about suspected abuse in the home or were very old, and that the diocese had already been very open about the ones that were confirmed as sexual abuse.
If somebody was in a position of leadership in public ministry, at the time that they were removed from service, the diocese issued a press release both to the general public and to the media, but also to the community that was affected by the abuse.
Valenti said her work turned up 5 confirmed abusers, all already relieved of their duties and 3 of them dead. Wrapping up the week, 5 area school districts awaited a judge's decision on their assertion that a Missouri law allowing students to transfer in out of the unaccredited Kansas City district is an unfunded mandate, and Sporting Kansas City survived a pregame storm, overtime, and penalty kicks to win the U.S. Open Cup. This is KCUR.
When Kansas City Actors Theater started fishing for a theme for the launch of its 8th season, the founders first picked a play, then tailored a similar one around that, and are now poised to give audiences what they're calling its Summer of Mystery. Opening this week is Agatha Christie's The Mousetrap, which is marking its 60th anniversary in London and is believed to have laid the foundation for all subsequent theatrical mysteries. KCUR's Steve Walker reports.
The St. Martin's Theater in the London equivalent of Broadway, the West End, is currently housing Agatha Christie's seminal mystery, The Mousetrap, which, like the Queen herself, is celebrating its own Diamond Jubilee.
In connection with the murder, the police are anxious to interview a man seen in the vicinity wearing a dark overcoat, light scarf, and soft felt hat.
Kansas City Actors Theater has, in its 8th season, staged some scabrous dramas like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and Glengarry Glen Ross. So a British drawing room mystery that's been staged countless times in community theaters and high schools alike was kind of unexpected, even for one of its cast, Gary Neil Johnson.
When I first heard that they were doing The Mousetrap, I thought, you know, rural? The Mousetrap, K-Cat doing the Mousetrap. And then the more I thought about it, one, it's got great credentials. I mean, we are talking about the longest running play in the Western world. How can you poo-poo that? And people need to see it.
Like Johnson, Natalie Licardello also plays a character who is suspected in the show's central murder. She believes that there are compelling reasons to revisit a play with what many call stock characters.
I play Molly Ralston. She's one of the proprietors of the guest house, and on the page she's just this really sort of stock ingenue, I guess, but when you like dig down a little bit deeper, there's darkness. She's quite the past, and it's fun to elevate the stock character to something deserving. There's times where we stop in rehearsal and we're like, oh my god, wait, they know this, by this point they know this, so if I know that, then I know you, and then if I know you, then it's, yeah. So it's a neat sort of web.
Directing the show is Mark Robbins, who's finding that the play not only offers viable theatrics, but intricate and unpredictable twists and turns.
It's just wonderful to see 2 hours being taken up by this interplay of characters. Invariably, all of them have some terrible, deep, dark secret. And the trick is that at some point during the evening, you as the audience member, we have to make sure that you suspect that any one of them is capable, fully capable, of bludgeoning someone to death. It's like a nightmare where you think that you're surrounded by people you know, when suddenly, just with a slight turn of perception in your brain, every one of them is a stranger, in a sense.
Of course, the payoff of any murder mystery is discovering the killer along with the detective. Robbins hopes to enlist the audience in keeping that secret.
When we started talking about doing it, I realized, you know, I don't remember how this play, I don't remember who done it. I don't remember how it turns out. But now there's been a long-standing tradition in the London production. At the end of the production, they say, please don't tell. You're on the honor system. Please don't give away the ending to anyone else. And I think we're going to carry on that tradition here. Make a plea to the audience to clam up after they leave.
5 days after closing the show, the theater is opening a more contemporary mystery, The Real Inspector Hound, said to be a comedic homage to The Mousetrap. Steve Walker, KCUR News.
Kansas City Actors Theater presents The Mousetrap through August 26th at Union Station's H&R Block City Stage. Find out more on our website at kcur.org. Just click on Arts and Culture.
Thanks for tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast or find us on iTunes. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at KC Currents.
KC Currents is produced by Suzanne Hogan.
And by Alex Smith.
Susan Wilson returns next week. Our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross, and our theme music is by Approach. I'm Alex Smith.
And I'm Suzanne Hogan.